From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. The Trump administration is rolling out a new rule today to fast-track deportations of people in the U.S. illegally. The change means that someone could be deported immediately without going before a judge. Joining us now is Univision News anchor Enrique Acevedo. Hi, Enrique.
Hi, Jeremy.
So this new fast-track deportation rule would apply to any immigrant who's been in the country illegally for less than 2 years. The old rule applied for those who were here illegally for just less than 2 weeks and were within 100 miles of the border. This is anywhere in the country. How significant is this change?
I think this is very significant. It just escalates the offensive against immigrants in the United States, which, you know, for the most part, according to the Pew Hispanic Center, have been here for 10, 12 years, even 15 years in many cases. So this is people who are living in places like, I don't know, Nebraska or Iowa, in Pennsylvania, and they're going to be approached by immigration officers in some cases, and they're going to demand and require that they prove that they've been here for longer than 2 years. But, you know, ICE has a record of not being completely careful sometimes in the way they roll out these policies. And I'm afraid that we're going to see a lot of people who don't fit in that profile of being here less than 2 years being detained and starting deportation proceedings. So this is just more of what we've seen from the administration in the last 2 years.
Well, and I was thinking just how this might play out with an individual. Let's say that ICE asks somebody for documentation to prove that they've been in the United States for more than 2 years, the kind of documentation that they would need to show could get other people in trouble. Let's say it's pay stubs that show that they've been working for 3 years in the United States. They might not want to show those pay stubs because then the employer is going to get in trouble, or then maybe a family member would get in trouble. So I imagine there are going to be people who have, as you say, been in the U.S. for longer than the 2 years who may be deported anyway.
Well, and the Trump administration has made everyone a deportation priority. They've been very public and very clear about this, Jeremy. So what happens if someone actually proves that they've been here for more than 2 years? Are they just going to let them go? Or are they also going to detain these people and, again, put them through deportation proceedings? And I think that's going to be the case. This is just an excuse to racial profile immigrants to have not judges, not the due process and rule of law, but supercharged immigration officers harass immigrants to try to demand from them documentation, and if they don't have it, regardless of how long they've been here, to detain them. And that's what really worries me. You know, we know President Trump launched his presidential bid back in 2015 promising massive deportations, not as a real comprehensive solution to the challenges created by a broken system, but as a political and electoral tool. And since he took office, he's taken every step within his authority to build a kind of deportation force that helps him create the electoral and political environment to succeed.
Now, the acting Homeland Security Secretary, Kevin McAleenan, is defending this new rule as a way to address what he calls a crisis along the southern border. President Trump has called it that as well. And McAleenan says that speeding up deportations will help free up beds at detention centers and alleviate a backlog in cases in immigration courts. What about that point?
Well, let's be clear. Trump's immigration legacy, Jeremy, is short but unequivocal. Failed, cruel, and inhumane policies that have aggravated that humanitarian crisis Kevin McAleenan refers to and has put even more strain on an immigration system that is clearly in need of a reset, but not like this. I think that's the tragedy of our immigration debate. Most people agree that we need solutions, that we need to change this. But also most people agree that the approach has to be humane, has to be compassionate, and it has to be a reference in terms of what the world does on immigration. This is immigration has a global dimension, and the U.S. has not set an example, a positive example to other nations. I guess in the contrary, it's lowering the bar on how countries should react to the challenges that immigration creates.
How are immigrant communities in this country responding to this, especially given the context here, which is that President Trump had been promising these raids in major cities on people in the country illegally, and those raids never materialized?
I would say that it's gone from fear to anger and now disappointment. the immigrant communities are as ready as they've been for this kind of offensive. They now have the tools and information so they can, know their rights and know how to react to this environment. But beyond that, when I say disappointment, Jeremy, I mean, I think people are expecting decent Americans, those who believe in the rule of law and in due process, to step up, to recognize that they've been using that as a country, this economy has been using immigrant labor for very long, benefiting from that. And now that they are being used as scapegoats, no one is coming out to defend them. No one is coming out to defend their right to the American dream and to a path to citizenship after living in this country in average for more than 10, up to 15 years, and creating important bonds in the community, family, and creating value for our nation. So I guess, it's gone from fear to anger and now disappointment. And, regardless of that, I think now they're more ready than ever to face the challenges that the administration has presented to them.
That's Enrique Acevedo, a news anchor with Univision. Enrique, thanks as always.
Thank you so much, Jeremy.
Well, you may have heard the Bill of the Month investigations from NPR and Kaiser Health News, listeners submitting whopping surprise bills that come, for instance, when patients are treated at a facility that's covered by their health insurance, but a doctor or provider isn't in the patient's network. Well, last week, the House Energy and Commerce Committee passed legislation to rein in surprise medical bills. And as IdeaStream's Marlene Harris-Taylor reports from Cleveland, some hospitals say they're also taking steps to keep patients from being saddled with these unexpected charges.
Can you go upstairs and get your trucks? Okay. Can you put that in the trash?
No, but the crayons can't go with you.
Jody Cressup-Gee has her hands full with three kids, including her youngest, who's home with her today. She and her family had just relocated to the Cleveland area from Missouri when her five-year-old daughter cut her foot. Cressup-Gee says her daughter came into the kitchen screaming.
There was just a trail of blood behind her. Her foot's all bloody. And I'm going, oh, no. I don't even know where to go because we just moved here and it's a Sunday.
Cressup-Gee checked her insurance company's website to find an in-network hospital where the bill would be covered. Her daughter received stitches in the ER, and Cressup-Gee paid her $250 copay and thought that was the end of it. Then a bill arrived in the mail.
Even though the hospital itself is in-network, as I found out later, the doctors who are there aren't necessarily in-network. And we got this big bill for $910, and I was like, what? I thought we had good insurance. What is this?
Cressup-Gee tried disputing the charges, but after months of fighting, she paid the bill.
There was no way to resolve this, and I don't want to say like nobody's at fault, but everybody's at fault. It's like that kind of a thing, and we got stuck in the middle.
Officials at university hospitals in the Cleveland area, where Cressup-Gee's daughter was treated, say patient privacy issues prevent them from discussing Cressup-Gee's specific bill. But the hospital system recently unveiled a new patient financial bill of rights, which, when fully in place, would keep future patients from receiving surprise charges. Here's UH Vice President Kathy LeBrew.
We're working to synchronize so that those organizations, they are participating with our payers in network.
Okay, but you're not there yet, right now.
We're not there yet. We're working toward that.
So at what point do you think all your people will be in network?
That'd be a hard question for me to answer.
LeBrew says right now, UH is committed to making sure patients are aware before scheduled procedures that they could get hit later with out-of-network charges. Other hospitals in the Cleveland area say they have similar policies. But even with the Patient Financial Bill of Rights, patients in emergency situations like Cressup-Gee's may still get treated by doctors in ERs who are out of network, especially at satellite locations off the main campus of hospitals. Soon, however, hospitals around the country may be required to do more. Bipartisan bills are being considered by both the U.S. House and Senate that would regulate hospitals and insurance companies on this issue. And President Trump has publicly declared his support for Congress addressing surprise bills. U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Midwest Director Douglas O'Brien says these surprise bills are driving consumers crazy. But some hospitals and clinics are getting the message.
They understand they have got to produce more consumer-friendly interactions with patients if they're going to survive.
Case Western Reserve University Health Finance Professor J.B. Silvers says it will take time to convert a complex medical payment system that includes hospitals, contracts with doctor groups, and numerous insurance companies.
They can treat this as not just a financial issue, but as a patient relations question. So if you take it from that point of view, then do you want to have in one of your regional hospitals a contract with an outside physician group to cover certain things that you can't do on your own? Probably not, because you know that's going to lead to problems like the surprise bills.
Silvers agrees change is coming on surprise bills, but other issues like bringing down the cost of health care are more complicated, and it will take a long time to find the right solutions. For Here and Now, I'm Marlene Harris-Taylor.
There has been an ongoing debate about reparations to right some of the wrongs of slavery. Last month, a House subcommittee heard from writer Ta-Nehisi Coates, who made his case by referring to something called Black Wall Street.
This body has a chance to both make good on its 2009 apology for enslavement and reject fair-weather patriotism. To say that a nation is both its credits and its debits. That if Thomas Jefferson matters, so does Sally Hemings. That if D-Day matters, so does Black Wall Street.
Black Wall Street refers to the Greenwood section of Tulsa, Oklahoma, a wealthy African-American community until it was burned to the ground in 1921 by a white mob. More than 300 African-Americans killed. It used to be inaccurately called the Tulsa Race Riot, but now it's referred to as what it was, the Tulsa Race Massacre. And next year marks 100 years on. It's an incredible story, still reverberating as Tulsa debates what to do next year. We wanted to learn more from Brenda Alford. Her grandparents and great-uncle owned the Nails Brothers Shoe Shop in Greenwood. Brenda, thanks for speaking with us.
Yes, thanks for having me.
Is this something that you heard about growing up?
No, it is not. I didn't hear about the race massacre while I was growing up, ironically. I knew about the businesses that our family had. My grandfather was a very proud college-educated shoemaker. And he and his brother Henry Nails owned the Nails Brothers Shoe Shop. That was the main businesses. They also had at that same location a record shop. They were also owners of the Nails Park and Dance Pavilion. And also they had the first community skating rink.
Well, and this was before. There's a before and after that night. On May 31st, 1921, a 19-year-old African-American, Dick Rowland, went to a building downtown, stepped into an elevator, and the elevator operator screamed. Now, historians have written that he might have stepped on her foot, and so she screamed. But he was arrested. He was taken to the courthouse. Newspaper headlines read, "Nab Negro for attacking girl in elevator to lynch Negro tonight." And some black men came to the courthouse.
Right. Basically, there was a group of men who were going to go and try to help out. And they were met with opposition. At one point, according to history, a white man asked one of the black men who had a gun what he intended to do with the gun. And the black man said, "Use it if I have to." They were there basically to try to protect Dick Rowland, because it was rumored within the community that this group of white men was going to go and try to hang him. Mm. I had not heard about the race massacre aspect of our family history. I did not find out about it until about 2003, when I received a notification from a legal entity here in Tulsa that myself and many others were being included in a lawsuit against the city of Tulsa and other entities, basically regarding reparations for survivors and descendants of survivors of the 1921 race massacre. That's how I found out, and I have to say that I was pretty devastated.
Right, to live your whole life and not know that this had happened.
Well, exactly.
Well, let's get back to the story. As you said, the white man says to the black, and by the way, these black men who came to help Dick Rowland, they'd served in the war, you know,
yes,
and they'd come home to this segregated city and these false accusations. At any rate, there was a shot fired. Nobody was harmed in that moment. And
right,
then that white mob went to what was then known as Black Wall Street. Tell us what you found out, what happened that night.
Basically, gunshots were heard to be fired, and the neighbors, the people in the community, were trying to warn everybody that there was a mob coming through the city, and they were shooting and going into people's homes and having them to leave their homes, and they were going in and burning their homes. My grandparents, along with their then 2-year-old daughter, their family and friends, ran for their lives from our neighborhood went to one of the parks that was farther out and stayed there until they felt like it was okay to come back, only to find their homes and their businesses looted and burned to the ground.
Well, not just burned, but firebombed. There's been speculation that Tulsa was the first city in the U.S. to be bombed from the air because some of the white men went and flew their airplanes above Greenwood and dropped kerosene bombs on it.
Exactly, exactly. My grandparents and their community were running for their lives, they were being shot at, and the bombs were being dropped on them as well. So it was a horrendous situation.
Did they lose everything?
They did. They lost everything.
At least they didn't lose their lives.
Yes, and I am grateful for that, because my reality every day of my life is that if they had not survived that day, I wouldn't be talking to you right now.
But as we said, hundreds didn't survive. And there's speculation that there is a mass grave. A young white boy said he saw white men digging a trench in Oaklawn Cemetery. And there is speculation there's a mass grave there. And that's one of the questions being raised now, is whether to exhume it. What do you want?
I think it should be exhumed. It was well known amongst family members of mine that mass graves were there. As I contemplated why I didn't know about the race massacre, certain stories that I heard as a very small child came back to my memory. One of those was that when our relatives, my great uncles, would come to town to visit, and we'd be driving go to maybe some location within Tulsa, and we would pass by the Oaklawn Cemetery, the conversation would be, quote unquote, you know they're still over there as we pass that cemetery. And everybody in the car would agree, yes, they knew that they were still over there. And I was, like I said, a small child. I didn't understand what they were talking about, but of course now I do.
Right.
I would also find out later that I have a great-grandmother who was also a survivor of the race massacre, who is buried there, was buried there in 1925. However, a lot of the records for folks who were buried before and after the race massacre cannot be found.
Well, part of the debate as to whether or not to exhume, part of the debate is that it is also a cemetery, and it would potentially disturb the graves of people like your grandmother who are buried there. But there was a commission created in 1997 that recommended a physical investigation to clarify whether there's a mass grave. That never happened, and now there's a push to have that happen again. As we said, next year marks the 100-year centennial of this massacre. But there's still so much debate about how to talk about this. Do you worry that in talking about exhuming a mass grave and exhuming, you know, you're also digging up a painful past that some say maybe should stay in the past?
I believe that this whole situation, the discussion about the race massacre, you know, all of that was swept under the rug for many years. Some people, you know, were threatened with the very lives of their families if they said anything. I'm glad that in this day and time, it is being recognized. So, yes, I do feel like we should move forward with it, because I believe it would give some closure to those who lost family members and friends and in that situation. I know that my grandparents, they lost family, friends, neighbors that they never saw again.
Do you blame in any part your family or others in the African-American community for not talking about this?
No, I don't. Because I came to understand, I grew up in the Greenwood community myself as a little girl. And I have to say it was one of the happiest times of my life. And I believe that my grandparents, my father, all of our parents, they wanted us to grow up in a positive community so that we would maybe be able to right the wrongs that had been done. The call of the community was to get your education and so that you can provide the type of living that you would want to have for your family.
Well, that's, you know, part of Ta-Nehisi Coates' call for reparations. This is a disruption, a horror. I mean, people were murdered. But it's also an economic disruption that would set a family back for generations when you lose businesses.
Exactly. You know, our community was not able to pass on generational wealth. I watched in my time my uncle, my grandfather's son, who followed in his footsteps and got his degree in shoemaking. I watched as he tried to restart the business in the 70s and was unable to do it. And we saw the effects it had on him. It was absolutely horrible.
Do you find yourself trying to picture it? I mean, it is amazing to think of a 1921, in the heart of, you know, a segregated time in the U.S., a community, a black community, schools, hospitals, libraries, churches, so many businesses, as we say. It was Booker T. Washington that called it the Black Wall Street.
Yes.
Do you find yourself daydreaming about that? What that must have been?
Well, I remember after I found out about this aspect of our family history, one of the things I remember doing is going back and just taking a walk on Greenwood, where on the street where I grew up, and just taking a walk as I did as a child, walking to school every day, and just wondering why I didn't know it, and also just thinking, how could something as horrible, you know, as that was, happen in a community that I grew up in and found so loving and just so peaceful? It was hard to imagine that something so horrendous had occurred in that area so many years before.
But it did. That's Brenda Alford. Her grandparents and great uncle owned the Nails Brothers shoe shop in Greenwood in Tulsa, Oklahoma. It was destroyed, firebombed, along with just about the entire community in the 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre, the centennial next year. Brenda, thanks so much for talking to us about it.
Thanks for having me.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Emberwave, the revolutionary new personal thermostat. Ever wish feeling too hot or too cold were optional? As summer heats up outside, just press for a thermal wave designed to provide cooling relief. Over air-conditioned inside? Leave that sweater in the car and rely on Emberwave instead. Learn more at emberwave.com and use code NPR to save $50 at checkout. Emberwave, control your comfort.
The British oil tanker that was seized by Iran last Friday while traveling through the Strait of Hormuz remains in an Iranian port as tensions remain high between Iran and the West. The Strait of Hormuz is a stretch of water off the coast of Iran that a fifth of the world's oil passes through. CNN business correspondent Claire Sebastian joins us now with more. Hi, Claire.
Hi, Jeremy.
So the Strait of Hormuz is just 21 miles wide at its narrowest point. Why is it so important?
Well, Jeremy, it's partly because it's only 21 miles wide. It's very narrow. It's very fragile. And it's basically a single point of failure for about a fifth to a quarter of global oil supplies, whichever estimates you look at. 30% of the world's seaborne oil passes through there. About 80% of it is destined for Asia. The U.S. Energy Information Administration calls it the most important choke point for the global oil industry. Any kind of disruption there has a serious macroeconomic impact. And obviously, if you look at the geography there as well, that reinforces just how important it is and how much of a geopolitical flashpoint it is. There's Iran to the north of the Strait, Oman to the south, Saudi Arabia on the south side of the Persian Gulf. A lot of kind of competing geopolitical forces there. And now that we have threats, you know, potentially from Iran, they've made them before to close or control shipping there. It reinforces just, you know, again, how much of a narrow and fragile flashpoint this is.
And for the U.S., even as the U.S. has been producing more oil, thanks to the boom in shale drilling, it's still that important?
You know, it is. I think there is a bit of a cushion from the shale boom. U.S. crude production was up 17% last year. It's a staggering number. But that is just a kind of a smaller scale cushion from the potential for a supply shock in the Middle East. I think there is still a potential for disruption. The oil markets are kind of taking it in their stride. at the moment. But if there is some kind of closure or even more security issues or potentially military action there, that really could lead to a supply disruption in the oil markets that even the U.S. shale producers wouldn't be able to offset.
OK, so the U.S. and other countries are now considering building an international coalition to protect commercial ships in the Strait. Here's U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo on Fox News last week.
We're going to guarantee freedom of navigation throughout the Strait. This is an international challenge. This is important to the entire globe. The United States is going to make sure that we do take all the actions necessary, diplomatic and otherwise, that achieve that outcome.
And we've been hearing some plans from the UK as well. What are the US and UK likely to do here?
Well, you know, it was interesting that soundbite from Mike Pompeo, because just a few weeks earlier, President Trump was questioning whether the U.S. military should continue to protect world oil supplies through the Strait of Hormuz, especially since, as he pointed out, most of them are not coming from or destined for the U.S. But we have had certain plans articulated. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs in the U.S., General Dunford, has laid out a potential plan where the U.S. could potentially provide command and control ships and lead surveillance in the region while its allies do the actual escorting of ships through the Strait of Hormuz with their own navies. There have been a number of joint statements. They're clearly trying to give diplomatic pressure a try. But there's another wild card in here, don't forget, and that's the fact that the UK has a new prime minister. Boris Johnson has been catapulted headfirst into this crisis. And there's a question of how much he's going to want to work with the US, especially since, don't forget, all of this goes back to the US withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal. That was unilateral. The UK and other European countries have actually been trying to save it. Will Boris Johnson continue to try to save it, or will he go more the way of the US? I think that may be one of the defining features of how this situation progresses.
CNN business correspondent Claire Sebastian. Claire, thank you.
Thanks.
And it's official. Boris Johnson is Britain's next prime minister. Under Britain's parliamentary system, his Conservative Party cast the only votes. He got 92,000 of them. So now the former mayor of London, former foreign secretary, former columnist with what colleagues called a loose relationship with the truth, who delighted fans by skewering the EU, will lead Britain's exit from the EU. He spoke today about uniting a country polarized by Brexit.
We again have to reconcile two sets of instincts, two noble sets of instincts, between the deep desire for friendship and free trade and mutual support in security and defence between Britain and our European partners, and the simultaneous desire for democratic self-government in this country.
We'll hear more elsewhere about what Boris Johnson means politically, but who is he? He comes from a family well known in Britain, like Johnson, against Brexit before they were for it. Colorful, as Sarah Lyle of the New York Times writes, they hold a place in British life that's somewhere between a comic version of the Kennedys and the Kardashians. She is in London. Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
And we'll link people to your recent writing. It's terrific. But as you all know, many Brits think that Boris Johnson is a buffoon. His former editor at The Telegraph warned he's unfit for national office. Others think he's brilliant. So first, what are you hearing on the street?
Well, there are two sides to him. He is super articulate. He's very smart. He's very well educated. He comes across as a smart person when he wants to be. But the other side of him is sloppy and poorly prepared, and he likes to wing it at the last minute. And I think one of the big questions people have is which of these two Boris Johnsons will come to the fore now that he's prime minister. He's sort of gotten through his career mostly on charm and bluster and saying interesting stuff without a lot of follow-through, and it doesn't seem likely that you can do a good job as prime minister if you take that approach.
Yeah. Another one of his editors said, you know, you can play loose with the truth, you can be confrontational and controversial and entertaining, but I'm not sure that's what we want for our prime minister. But start with that start to his career. A columnist, he was based in Brussels, he was 24, banging out what The Independent called semi-true dispatches, upper-class, Oxford-educated, but with this new kind of gleeful, hip, conservative style of lying. I mean, talk a little bit about him as a columnist.
He was sent to Brussels to cover the European Union for the Daily Telegraph, which is a conservative-leaning newspaper. And it's a boring story. You know, it's a story about bureaucrats. It's a story about legislation. And his approach was, I will write in the most entertaining way possible, and I will put in the newspaper half-truths, sort-of-truths, untruths, in order to advance the general theme that the European Union is an out-of-touch bureaucracy who's trying to stop the people of Britain from doing the things they want. And he got a reputation as being the most entertaining reporter writing from Brussels at the time. And it also appealed very much to a strain of the Conservative Party that distrusted Europe and didn't like the European Union.
Well, Martin Fletcher, who was his former Times editor, put together this list of some of the things that he said that were not true. He wrote that the EU wanted to standardize coffins, the smell of manure, and the size of condoms. Not true. He warned Brits that their prawn cocktail-flavored chips would be banned, their sausages were under threat, and their fishermen would have to wear hairnets. Not true. But Johnson himself told an interviewer, this was in 2005, everything I wrote from Brussels, I was sort of chucking these rocks over the garden wall, and it was fun to hear them crash through the greenhouse on the other side. He started to really like this.
He did. He started to get a reputation for himself as someone who was really telling the truth about the EU, and it started to affect Conservative Party policy. Margaret Thatcher, back in the 90s, had said he was her favorite reporter from Brussels, and it started to inform that strain of Conservative Party thinking. And so it very much appealed to what some people wanted to hear about Brussels. And it was really a dangerous thing because it infected all the coverage of Brussels from all the newspapers because his competitors were under pressure from their own editors to write stories about the sort of things that Boris was writing about. And they would tell their editors these things are untrue. And the editors will say, well, Boris has it, and they'd be under pressure to sort of come up with the same kind of things. It had a much wider effect than just one person writing something in one newspaper.
Yeah. Well, so now he takes center stage in Britain, and onto the stage also troops his family, very much already on the stage. Why was his family so well known?
You know, it's an interesting family. His father actually worked for the European Union, worked as a member of the European Parliament. They were raised partly in Brussels. There were four kids. Three of them have white blonde hair, just like their dad. And they were raised to be really competitive, and they were raised to all want to be public figures, it feels like. They're all very bright. They all went to Oxford. Some of them are writers. Another of Boris's brothers is a former journalist who's now a member of parliament. His sister is a columnist, a writer, an author, a reality TV star. His dad is a reality TV star. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, you know, they're doing what a lot of kind of the chattering classes, as they're called here, do to make a living. And they've all slightly glommed on to Boris's brand as a way to associate themselves with him and possibly burnish their own brands as he's gone toward becoming prime minister.
Well, this is fascinating because, well, first of all, Chia, first family that's involved with reality shows, how could that ever happen? You know, we, of course, have
but,
that
you
here.
Know, it's sort of smaller scale. You know, it's like, I'm a celebrity, get me out of here. So his dad was on that. His sister was on Celebrity Big Brother. But, you know, it is a small world in Britain. It doesn't feel as kind of insane as it would if, let's say, one of the Trump kids was on a TV show like that. Of course, Trump Sr. was on a TV show like that, but not since he's become president.
But it is interesting because you mentioned Stanley, the father, well-known environmentalist, as you said, worked for the EU, was very much a Remainer against Brexit. Brother Joe, member of parliament, was very much against Brexit. In fact, tried to work within the group to craft a deal for then Prime Minister May. Sister Rachel, columnist, novelist, former magazine editor, talk show, talking head, reality TV star, tried to run for a seat on the European Parliament, failed, but was very much pro-Remain. All of them have thrown out their own ideals to now join their brother Boris and be pro-Brexit. All but one, Leo, the only sibling who's not blonde, who seems to, you know, be the one most willing to speak out against his brother when Boris Johnson said that women in burqas look like, I think, bank robbers in letterboxes. Brother Leo finally came out of some sort of silence to tweet out, I would hope this round of competitive bigotry could end. Silence doesn't mean consent. He's married to a Muslim.
He's married to a Muslim. He actually has been very quiet. I mean, it feels pretty clear that he's pro-Remain. He has not been political. He has not come out with his family on any of these political rallies that Boris has been in. As for Rachel, she's very much still pro-Remain, but she's sort of come around as a supporter of her brother.
Well, and the members of the Conservative Party have, in effect, voted in the entire family. But, of course, Boris Johnson is prime minister. What's the sense going forward? You said the question is, which one will they get? We also have to put into the mix calls to his home about a domestic dispute. Calls recently that everyone in Britain should speak English, which, of course, people in Wales, other parts of Britain that don't speak English were upset about this. What is the sense of what kind of a leader they're going to get?
Well, he really has come in at a very difficult time in public life because the looming issue over the next few months will be Brexit. It doesn't feel like there's going to be a lot of time in the next few months to engage in some of that other stuff. I think, you know, he will put out his legislative agenda tomorrow when he makes his speech outside Downing Street as prime minister. But again, the main thing he's going to have to do is Brexit, and he's going to have to be pretty serious. I mean, Europe needs to be negotiated with. At the moment, it feels like they don't really respect him, and he's going to have to show that he is can rise to an occasion and can be a statesman and can have real policies and can kind of stop making off-the-cuff jokes and remarks that are fine when you're not really in power but look very different when you are in power.
We will see. Sarah Lyle of the New York Times, and we'll link you again to her writing about Boris Johnson and his family at hearnow.org. Sarah, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Have you seen FaceApp, the thing everyone is using where they upload a photo of themselves to see what they'd look like as a younger or older person or a person of a different gender? It's all done through algorithms. And it turns out the company everyone has been uploading their photos to is based in Russia. Concerned? Well, let's get to our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Kara Swisher is editor-at-large at Recode. Hi, Kara.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm doing well. So first of all, is there any reason to suspect FaceApp of privacy abuses just because it's based in Russia?
No. A lot of security consultants just think it's an sort of an onerous agreement that you agree to, but not unlike others that you agree to. And there's no proof that they are doing anything nefarious with these pictures that you upload of yourself as an aged person.
So what do you make of what we're hearing from politicians, including the Democratic Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, who wants the FBI and the Federal Trade Commission to investigate FaceApp for possible national security and privacy risks?
Well, I think it's just a lot of noise and hand-waving in that case. The thing is, he might know something I don't know, but I think what happened was this: the DNC said, instructed the candidates and their staff not to download it. I mean, I think they were burned the last election when, you know, all those emails got out and there was all that hacking. And so they're trying to be super careful about the staff and what it allows on its phones and what it allows to be distributed.
That said, when you think about all of the facial recognition technology and how it's being used now, we already know that people are boarding planes on some airlines just by using their face, even if they haven't given, let's say, JetBlue the ability to do that with government data. People are being checked via driver's license photos to see if they're actually a legal immigrant in this country. Should we be more careful at this point about where we allow our face to be uploaded and who we're giving it to?
Well, you know, the jig is up. If you've downloaded anything to Facebook or any of the service or Instagram or any of those services, there's tons of you already put your face everywhere. Mm-hmm. So, you know, no one has the bigger trove of faces than Facebook. Obviously, it's called that. And so I think you've just already done this if you have any, you know, involvement in most of the social media services on the internet. And so the question is, how protective of their are they being of the photos that we've uploaded there? What rights do they have over those photos? I think they pretty much couldn't use them any way they want at this point when, and under those agreements. And whether there should be legislation to give you control over the photos or any other information that you upload.
Does it make any difference, though, that in this case we're talking about Russia? I mean, I know you already answered that question. Facebook's got all this information, too. But when you're talking about a government that is, or let's say China, a more authoritarian government, right, does it make a difference?
Well, I think you have to think hard about it. There's a very popular app among teenagers and others called TikTok, which is really, it's one of the first apps that is of Chinese origin that has really swept this country in terms of popularity. And so, yeah, I think I would be, you know, these are authoritarian governments. These photos or videos, in the case of TikTok, it's videos, are going somewhere. Now, they, you know, in FaceApp's case, they say they're using Amazon and Google storage services. But the fact of the matter is, these are companies that are based in countries where the government has a whole lot more control of the companies that reside in those countries. And so you've got to be paying attention, but I don't think people are, because they like dancing in front of a video, or they like aging their face or things like that. But I'm very interested in the source of any kind of software that's on my phone.
You just got back from the Aspen Security Conference. What kind of discussions were people there having about cybersecurity and this sort of thing?
Well, this isn't new to the people there. You know, this has just been a consumer freak out on the fact with FaceApp. But I think a lot of discussions were about, you know, the malevolent use of technology. Not every single subject was, but it was in the thread of every single discussion. A lot of it was about China and the hegemony of China over a lot of things, including technology over the coming years. And I think, you know, Russia has been, as everybody knows, with hacking and things on Facebook and everything else has been playing games in all kinds of ways, especially around elections. But I think most people there were more concerned about the actual dominance of China militarily and also technologically.
Carrie, I want to ask you about one more thing while we have you.
Sure.
Some of the big news in the tech world today, which is that Apple is in talk to buy Intel's smartphone modem chip business. What would be the significance of that?
Well, they want control over what's in their phones so that they have control over the development of key aspects of their phones. I mean, I think one of the interesting things at this conference was that they were talking about something called sovereign clouds. Like every company, every country has their own little country, I guess, in terms of technology. And I think probably Apple wants more control over the device that it has. It's its most important thing going forward and doesn't have to rely on a partner over a key device.
Kara Swisher, editor-at-large at Recode. Thanks as always.
Thank you.
Robin, I don't know about you, but I have no interest in seeing what I look like when I'm, I don't know, 75, 85,
mirror.
No thanks. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here Now.